Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. My name is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. This episode is brought to you by OneCause, leader in online, mobile, and virtual fundraising software. OneCause supports over 6,000 nonprofits to reach more and raise more with innovative solutions. You can visit their virtual fundraising resource center at www.onecause.com.
Hi, Arnie. Thank you for being my guest today on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We've had you before, and we yet to broadcast that previous conversation. It got a little dated given the sort of the change in climate, I guess we might say. So before we tackle sort of the question that we have in mind, would you mind just introducing yourself and your company to our listeners?
Yeah, sure, Jason. Thanks again for having me on your podcast. I hope you, your family, and all your listeners are healthy. My name's Arnie Papp. I'm the CEO and co-founder of QBAC, and QBAC uses technology to reimagine alumni engagement and do large-scale discovery for development offices.
Yeah. So Arnie, before we hit the record button, the conversation you and I agreed that we would have, which I'm really eager to sort of hear your thoughts because I'm just not a technology guy. I think you've sort of gotten the impression in our brief conversations before. Most of my listeners know that I'm not a big technology guru of sorts. So the question I'm asking you to sort of help me and my listeners understand is where is technology going to take fundraising in sort of the post-COVID world? So when we think about this notion of a new reality and all the unpredictable and uncertain about what our future is going to be, where do you think technology is going to take us? And then, like, how is a company like yours sort of keeping up with that? What are you anticipating? Because I have to imagine that QBAC is seeing all sorts of things sort of you can't live in the Silicon Valley like you do and not be thinking about this stuff. So take us on a journey, if you will, my friend.
Okay. Thanks, Jason. So I just want to preface my answer saying, I lived in Japan for 12 years, and the Japanese word for crisis is made up of two characters. One means danger and the other means opportunity. So yes, there's real danger in the world, but I also think there's an opportunity to rethink alumni engagement and fundraising to do it differently and more effectively. So my big idea is that the future will see development leveraging technology more for the discovery portion of the fundraising process. And so I see a future where development offices can spend more time with more prospects building deep long-term relationships. And so, we're in a moment of time where solicitations are paused, but discovery doesn't have to be and shouldn't be, But I look at the current situation, there's challenges. Okay. So, the primary tool for development offices is the face-to-face meeting, but we all know that those have been suspended. And my take is old alumni, the world is not going to immediately go back to where it was because the older alumni who were the prospects, prime prospects for major gifts, principal gifts, planned gifts. I'm one of those older alumni baby boomer myself, and the risk reward equation is very different to a millennial, right? And so I expect older alumni to be reluctant and slowly come back into doing face-to-face. We have that. So that's one challenge to deal with. The other one is, of course, is hiring freezes, severely constrained budgets, right? Then the third point that I see challenge is that development offices are going to have to significantly increase their pipeline in order to get the same dollars, but they're doing it with the same headcount. right? So how do you square that triangle? You know, and that's where I think technology can play a very important part, because it's an effective way to scale a fundraising operation. And I look at it as a force multiplier for development officers, not as a replacement, you know. And that's, you know, I think we talked about before, you know, our slogan is AI with a human touch, you know. So I, even though I'm from Silicon Valley, and so, you know, of course I love technology, but you have to use technology smartly. And so, yes, you know, I believe technology can help uncover actionable insights that can help with cultivation, but ultimately it takes a human to apply their creativity and their experience as a fundraiser to use those insights for cultivating those deep lifelong relationships. So
you guys are the ones who sort of really get this tension between what is called, what Peter Thiel refers to, which I oftentimes refer back to. It's this notion of being complementary rather than competitive with technology. And I think the first time you and I talked, I really felt like I was hearing from a guy who understood that we in the fundraising space needed to learn how to allow fundraising technology to play this complementary role and not allow it to usurp our own roles and become sort of this competitive sort of thing.
One of my favorite songs is In the Living Years by Mike and the Mechanics. And one of the lines I love is, we'll talk a different language, talking in defense. And you have a...
Arnie, you're aging yourself.
I know. But I admitted I'm a baby boomer up front. I'll take it on the chin.
I know the song really well, but I'm not going to tell you who played it in my house when I was about 6 years old.
Hey, stop showing off.
I wasn't six. I was probably like 10, but I was 10. But how old were you, Arnie, when that song
I must have been 11 or 12 then.
You weren't.
So, you know, in your book, you had a kind of related quote from George Bernard Shaw on the same thing. And so when I look at fundraising, and this is, you know, I look at it in transactional fundraising and relationship fundraising. And so transactional, it's, you know, the high volume, low dollar value, low touch. And this is where technology, you need to drive efficiency, right? But it's, and this is where, you know, technology, you know, can often play a larger role and perhaps supplanting some of the work that has been historically done by a human, for example. However, on the relationship fundraising side, which is low volume, high dollar value, high touch, this is where technology will be complementary. And because now it's not a volume issue, it's about a win-loss ratio. It's about human relations, right? And that's where, you know, as I said, you know, technology can complement, can be a force multiplier, and you want to be smart. You know, you want to look at the fundraising process and see, okay, where can I use technology effectively and efficiently, and where does it not make sense? You know, and so, you know, there was an interesting situation recently where, you know, there were automated emails went out to alumni at several universities, actually, that were doing planned giving requests, you know, and, you know, that's an example where, you know, that illustrates how important it is to have a human at the wheel, right? And clearly that was a suboptimal time to be asking, you know, elderly alumni for a planned giving request. And so it's all, I think it's a positive thing. And in this environment, even more so, but it depends how it's done. It's not just like throw it out there because it's about who you're engaging with, not just how many and how you engage, you know, and technology can uncover, not just insights, but enable you to collect data that you can then combine engagement data, which is, you know, digital online engagement plus real world, and combine that with capacity analysis, willingness analysis. And so you get a more data-driven operation, and that should result in, you know, better quality decision making, I think.
What a company like yours is going to be trying to do, if you're not already doing it, is you're going to try to expedite and speed up the discovery process so that we can more quickly get to, say, even just having this conversation here, even if it's a remote conversation. Am I right?
Yeah, that's exactly it. You know, as I mentioned at the beginning, you know, wouldn't it be better if the development officer could spend more time with more prospects and basically get down to those important things quicker about, okay, why, you know, basically what we're trying to uncover is what makes a prospect tick. You know, we're not using technology to uncover, hey, do you read Time magazine? Do you like television? Do you support the forum? Now, that's not going to help necessarily in cultivation. It might help in starting a conversation. But what a development officer wants to understand is, you know, what makes my prospect tick? You know, what do they care about? Who do they care about? Why do they care? How are they emotionally connected to my university? Because this is the other challenge that's going on is there are 1.2 million other charities in the US. A lot of people hurting throughout the country. All those charities will be also competing for your alumni's charitable dollars because they're all doing good work. So how do you stand out from that? You have to uncover and strengthen emotional connection and alumni identity. And that's what we're doing because then if I call it putting more tools in the toolbox for the development officer. That's how I think it. And it's all about increasing the probability of success. There's no magic bullet out there. These are, you know, relationships that take years to cultivate. So what we're doing is just giving them more tools so they can be more effective and hopefully, you know, get to the core of what emotionally connects an alumni quicker.
What I believe is particularly problematic for a lot of my listeners is that they're in many ways attempting to do the same work that I think companies like yours are getting increasingly and increasingly better at doing. And that's what I mean when we confuse this notion of technology playing a competitive versus a complementary role. I think we've got lots of fundraisers that have historically tried to have their whole professional identities wrapped up in the discovery process prior to the point at which the information gets on. Say, for instance, I was your prospective donor. There's a role that a company like yours is playing all the way up until the point when the telephone or the Zoom call or Zencast or whatever platform we happen to be using, there's a role that a technology company like yours plays. And then there's a point at which the line is drawn, and now the human being needs to be playing that more meaningful role. Technology now becomes sort of the backup, which is essentially what this platform is doing. And I don't know. I think a lot of, say, for instance, your clients, I think a lot of your clients are probably up to speed on this. And I think maybe the development officers that are working for those institutions are up to speed. But I don't know if the average Joe or the average Sally development officer that's working for the local food bank is necessarily thinking this way. Does that make sense?
Yes. And this is where, you know, I look at the fundraising process, the pipeline. The work of identifying and qualifying prospects is critical, sure. But I've done decades of relationship selling. So I know, and I've managed teams as a VP of people who do that, you know, with annual quotas, multi-million dollar software, et cetera, et cetera. It's not what goes in the pipeline that counts. It's what comes out the other end. Okay. So then you have, then you have the value chain. And so people have to identify where is the maximum value that I can offer. When I was very young, I read Somerset Maugham, and that's probably going to date me as well. But he said something, he had a cleaner. I can't remember exactly what is it. And someone said, well, why do you have a cleaner? He said, look, I could clean the house myself, just like my cleaner can, but only I can write novels like I can. So it's all about kind of like the Adam Smith thing, you know, you specialize in the areas where you can add the most value. And I would posit that the most value that any development officer can add is in cultivating that relationship. And so that's the starting point. And anything else that you're doing that is not focused on that, you need to evaluate and determine, could this be done by someone else? Could it be done by technology? Is there another way of doing it? Because this is the critical success factor, right? And so that's how I think people should. It's not a question of can I do it, but should you be doing it?
Is there a difference between a technology, a tool, we'll call it a tool, we won't call it technology. Is there a, there has to be a difference between a tool that that encourages you to compete with other tools versus a tool that you allow to get a particular part of the job done so that you can actually get really good at the part that you're really good at. Do you follow what I'm saying? I'm sort of going totally, I'm sort of riffing on the
idea. Going off the reservation, are you, Jason?
I'm thinking of technology is going to increasingly get better, and it may be critical moments like this where their employer is seeking after and looking for greater efficiency, say in that discovery process, that they're going to therefore seek out companies like yours to assume responsibility for that initial part of the process. And then, just like you just said, and then now expect the fundraiser to be the most talented relationship building person that they possibly can be. And historically, fundraisers haven't had that type of a job description. They've been invited and encouraged to play that entire sort of spectrum of responsibilities. Right. And I think technology is going to increasingly play that initial role. Mm-hmm. It's like, so I'm a baseball guy. Maybe this will make better sense. Technology is going to increasingly get us to first base, mm-hmm. and we're going to need fundraisers to run us all the way around.
Yeah.
But technology is going to do its job. And if you think your job is just to get to first base, the likelihood is that you're maybe not as employable as you were in, say, a pre-COVID-19 sort of economy. Does that fit?
Yes. And I've never played baseball. It's not a big sport where I come from in Australia. But that being said, I do know in a lot of sports or endeavors, you have generalists and specialists. And so I would look at the development officer as a specialist. Yes, you could make them a generalist, but they're more effective. They add more value in that specialist role. You mentioned sort of technology and kind of how it's evolved, you know, over the decades. And, you know, when I first started in the industry, it was about product-centric. It was about products and features, and you would license the software, et cetera. And then we shifted to a different way of looking at the world where it's not just customer-centric, but it's more solution-oriented, right? And so how does that technology fit into the ecosystem, right? And knowing that that ecosystem comprises of both other technologies and other humans, all of them specializing thing. And it's about, you know, bringing that, making that cohesive and focused on that goal, the goal, and then understanding how each component can be optimized to achieve the maximum return and effectiveness and efficiency so that as a whole, you know, you get more likely to achieve your objectives. Yeah.
So, Arnie, one of the things I've heard you say, and this is obviously very specific to the higher ed space, but what your company is trying to do is sort of reimagine alumni engagement. So through the lens of everything we've just sort of seen, maybe as sort of a case study, tell me what does that look like for you all? And what do you mean when you say reimagining all this?
Okay. And as you can imagine, this is a big topic. So bear with me here.
That's fine.
First of all, you know, it can't be one size fits all. It has to be hyper-personalized because that's what alumni expect. You know, when you and I log on to Netflix and Amazon, we see very different content, right? Second, I'm going to drill down on some of these points a little bit more, but second, it has to take into account that every alumni is at a different stage of their professional and personal lives, right? And so I have this 3P3S framework, which breaks down those stages into social approval, society approval, and self-approval. The point is that the interests and needs of a 25-year-old new graduate are different to a 45-year-old married mid-career alumni and very different to those of a retired empty nester baby boomer alumni, right? And then, it's not a static thing. We all move through those stages over time. So the system has to not only understand how to personalize, but also how to adapt as those needs change, right? The other point is It's about engagement with a purpose, right? And this is in our particular case, you know, there's multiple reasons why you want to engage with alumni. One of those, hopefully, is related to fundraising, and in particular, relationship fundraising. And so that's why we focus on uncovering actionable insights, et cetera, right? As I mentioned earlier on. So when you look at it like this, it's not about, the focus needs to be on who is being engaged, not how many are engaged. Because when you look at engagement through that fundraising lens, your metrics, your objectives, your metrics are going to be very different. It's not about getting 10, I could generate 10,000 likes on a university Facebook page by putting up a funny cat video. It doesn't help a development officer, though. It doesn't connect that alumni to the mission and the cause, that emotional connection is not there, right? So it's about who is being engaged, not how many, right? So I believe a portion of alumni engagement needs to reflect the gifting spectrum. And the reason why is you can't boil the ocean. So it's not about measuring engagement scores for all your alumni. You know, in theory, you could do that if you had unlimited budget, which no one does. So yes, alumni engagement needs to be data-driven. But again, you need to be selective about it. It's not cost-effective to do engagement scores for everyone. You need to focus on the small minority, which we all know, of alumni who donate the majority of the dollars, right? So 80% of the engagement effort should be on the 20%, And so who is in that category? So I would say it's your current major gift prospects. Two is alumni who are likely to become major gift donors in 5 to 10 years. And three, influencers on those two groups. Okay. So that then becomes a much more manageable number. So I can do personalization for everyone, but I can do hyper personalization for that smaller group where I'm going to have the biggest return on effort. Okay. So what is that kind of, how does that translate actually into, real world engagement, right? So one of the things with engagement is the 99-1 rule. And I'll just explain that because in my experience, half the people have heard of it, half the people have never heard of it. But it's a rule of thumb in Silicon Valley that applies to all online engagement platforms. You can Google it and look it up. It's been around for a long time. Whether it's Facebook, LinkedIn, doesn't matter, right? And what it means is 90% of your alumni are consuming content passively. 9% contribute to content by liking, commenting, sharing, etc. And only 1% of your alumni actually create content. So what, why is that important to understand that? the key things is that rule dictates both the quantity and the quality of cultivation insights. Okay. So given that, you want to change that rule. You don't want to fall. If you're not doing anything about that, you're going to fall into that rule of thumb. So what you want to do is shift people from that 90% category into the 9% and hopefully into the 1% category. Why? Because you will get better quantity and quality of insights for that. So then in order to change something, first of all, you have to measure where it is today. So you have to measure where it is today and then and have ways, which obviously we do, that you can break that that rule, for example, because by doing that, it's going to impact ultimately in your engagement ROI, right? So so that's, hopefully that, and then the other thing, sorry, about alumni engagement that I wanted to mention, yeah. It has to be, when I talk about a purpose, emotional connection and alumni identity. You've heard, I mentioned that earlier on. And I know you've had Travis McDearman.
A couple of times. Yeah.
Yeah. I call him the father of alumni identity because he's the first person to do a PhD in research in this area. I know Jay Dillon also followed up on that with his PhD, et cetera. And interestingly, sometimes something becomes obvious when you don't have something. And in Australia, the whole concept of alumni identity is so different. And I know many of your listeners, are concerned about declining participation rates. It's been going on for many years. it might make them feel better to know that in Australia, the participation rate is 0.6%, not 6%, 0.6%. Now, why is that? And, you know, so, you know, it's not that we don't have good quality universities or we don't like our university, but just that the concepts are different. And this is why I believe it. I know that it's kind of important to have that. You know, another example is, I know a guy who's in his 50s and, you know, once a month, you know, he's a partner in his own law firm. He's a very successful guy. But once a month, he wears Harvard apparel. You know, that's inconceivable in Australia. And Aussies, you know, love their sports. But no Aussie is going to pay money 20 years later to go watch a football team at their university. So we don't have that, and which makes me really appreciate why it's so important, and the work of, you know, Travis and Jay really makes a difference. And again, you know, because so what alumni engagement has to, in my view, uncover and strengthen emotional connection and alumni identity. Otherwise, you're just another one of the 1.2 million other worthy causes in the US. And we put a very particular focus on older alumni. Right from the get-go, we're being age friendly. Why? Lots of reasons. You know, one, because most social media is built by millennials for millennials, and the needs are different as people get older. And older alumni, of course, are the target market for major gifts, principal gifts, planned gifts, etc. So you need, but their distance away from that initial emotional connection and alumni identity is now 20, 30, 40 years, right? So you have to proactively engage to reignite and strengthen those two things, because they're the proven drivers of giving, right? So it's about, you know, engaging in a way that actually can help move the fundraising needle. It's not just engagement for engagement's sake, you know.
Yeah, so it's kind of fascinating, the example you offered, the gentleman who is wearing the Harvard. And I'm sort of pulling together all of the thoughts that you've brought to the conversation, but I'm also thinking about the conversations that I've had with the other guys who talk about alumni identity. And I'm interested in sort of hearing your thoughts on this idea that proximity now changing. So you're in the Silicon Valley on the West Coast right now. I'm close to the East Coast now myself. So we've got 3,000 miles between us, but by the use of technology, we've made proximity almost sort of irrelevant, right? But is it fair to say that even some of our identity signaling, I guess you, that we do, some of the identity signaling that we do, for instance, wearing Harvard garb to walk around town, is going to become less relevant, because if we choose not to get out of our houses as often as a result of this, for example, or if our identity signaling is sort of done in much more virtual places, guys like you and your company are going to be the first ones to sort of pick up on this stuff.
Right. And our identity is made up of, you know, I call it like circles, you know. And so there's the, you know, my alma mater. It could be I was in scouting or the military or whatever, you know, and then my identity is wrapped up with my family, you know, my kid, whatever. So it's a composite, right? But that one element that relates to the alma mater is critical. Now, I've come back onto that, but, you know, you raise an interesting point, is how are things going to evolve, you know? And if we move more into, online education, for example, you know, what created that? You know, I look at them, I'm fascinated how America can get alumni to wear, branded apparel 30 years later, which wouldn't happen in Australia. But it's because of all those, you know, the history, traditions, living in the dorm, you know, the Greek life. You know, there's many things that we don't have in Australia that make me think, okay, these are some of the things. When I look at my kids, you know, they went through the entire schooling system and went to university in California. So I watched their experience, and I think, okay, these must be some of the things that created that alumni identity and emotional connection, right? But then what happens when some of that goes away? What happens if there is more online education and people don't have that experience of living in a dorm and, you know, and physically going to a WOW week? Now, I'm not saying, you know, we're not completely going to that world for sure. Way, way in the distance, who knows? But there might be a part of that it just might, the percentage of that might increase as we move forward. And so then if that detracts from emotional connection and alumni identity, then, you know, can a digital experience, engagement experience, help counter the effects of any, you know, factors that might weaken it, so to speak, right? And so then looking at, you know, engagement, you know, one of the things that always fascinates me, like I live down the road from Stanford, you know, and they do a great job. You know, a lot of my friends are Stanford grads, and, you know, literally 30 years later, they can tap into that network, right? And it has value to them, lifelong value, right? And so I look at, I don't see any particular reason why other universities can't do that, because every alumni community has people with experiences, wisdom, talent, knowledge, etc. And I kind of, it's like having a library of books. You know, everyone's got something that they can contribute to the sort of the value of that online community. The challenge is, you know, how do I extract that? How do I organize? You can't just throw, dump a bunch of books onto the lawn. You know, you've got to be able to categorize it. Hey, if you're interested in career advice, if you're interested in life advice, it doesn't matter what stage of your personal professional life, you know, we've got in our community, we've got that knowledge and experience, and we're going to make it easy for you to tap into that, because that provides value, and that then can strengthen the identification, because now you're seeing value from being engaged, even on online, right?
With a heightened priority put on learning, the idea learning, institutional learning, not like learning like in the classroom learning, but the ability for an enterprise to learn and to gather information, rather than this sort of this emphasis on hoarding information as if the hoarded information is giving us some sort of advantage. But what I'm hearing about technology, what I'm hearing technology is going to enable us to do, and I'm sort of presuming that post COVID-19, we might see this to an even greater and more, in a faster sense, is the idea that once you've learned something, you've got to actually act on it very quickly. There's an expediency with which is going to be expected of all of us. So, for instance, going back to one of your very original sort of ideas, the idea that a development officer might have a larger portfolio and be expected now to manage relationships with a larger number of people. But there's also an expediency, a quickness that's going to be expected of him or her. They're going to have to be able to move very quickly. And I don't know. And it comes back to, again, the information. For instance, if I was a development officer and your program put information in front of me, and the information that's in front of me now, my boss is going to expect me to act on it relatively quickly. Because if I don't, that information very quickly becomes dated and stale and unuseful. A couple days, you know, maybe for a couple hours, right?
Right. So, I mean, there's a couple of things. I mean, people often talk about the number of gifts, the frequency, the gift size. I also think of it in terms of gift velocity, right? And so, if you have, from the time of initial engagement to the actual closing of an ask, you know, if that takes 4 years. Well, if you can get that down to 3 years, that's a real win, right? And so you have to be cognizant. So that, again, looking at that value chain, can I move faster along that value chain? Because again, the limiting factor in the process is the human. It's the most expensive resource, right? Even under circumstances where, you know, budgets were normal and you didn't have headcount freezes, you can only throw so many people at the challenge, so to speak, because that's the most expensive part of any budget, right? So the human is the limiting factor. So the quicker you can get them focused on things that are going to add value and move that prospect through the pipeline and increase that gift velocity, I think that's a good thing. Another thing that you kind of sort of alluded to is in terms of silos and stuff. And this is a common, when I used to be in the financial world, both in banking and also financial technology, dealing with major banks around the world, Wall Street, even governments, actually. And, you know, that was always historically a challenge in banking, silos, right? People hoarding information. And then people understood the connections between different financial products and risk management. You needed to sort of cooperate. And so that's, you know, I've seen that play out. And the silo approach is, it doesn't go the other direction. It's the silos get broken down, not put up historically in industries, right? So you have to be cognizant of that. The other reason is what I call a culture of philanthropy, right? In the for-profit world, that's called a sales culture. And the point is, you can't, an organization can't depend on a few individuals, no matter how talented they are. You want to put more wood behind the arrow, right? And so creating, this is kind of one of the things we think about when we do engagement, right, is how to create a culture of philanthropy so that everyone is kind of working together for that mission, in this case, you know, fundraising, right? Now, the challenge with that is, how do you get buy-in? You know, you can sort of mandate it. Hey, we have a culture of philanthropy today, and you can come up with some great messaging. But the reality is, the best way to motivate people is through self-interest. But then the challenge becomes how people often can't see the connections between what they do and what someone, a development officer, might be doing. You know, so how does someone in the library, you know, what have I got to do with fundraising, you know, or someone in career services or someone in recruiting? Now, I believe, because I've done this in the for-profit world, you know, where I've had to teach a QA person, you know, what you do actually is going to impact the success of the CFO. That's going to impact the CEO, et cetera. And so some of these connections are direct, you know, obviously alumni relations and development, a very sort of direct connection. But others are more indirect, and that's a challenge for people to sort of understand what those indirect connections are. Because then, if you can use data, if you can demonstrate to people how their work directly or indirectly impacts that objective of raising more funds, donations, then you're more likely to get buy-in. And people wanting to help out, and then I think the organization is just much, much better off if people can then see, you know, how all the pieces are connected, and that's what it's about. Everything's connected, you know, in life. The trick is understanding what those connections are and how to make a difference, you know, and pull different levers, so to speak. Yeah.
Okay, so I had a guest on here. This will be my last question, but I'm keeping you going because you got me thinking about all sorts of things, all sorts of technology related questions conversations that I've had in the last 12 months. So I had a woman on here that was a gift officer, mm-hmm. that was working remotely at the time and continues to. She's in the Chicago area, and I wonder if some of the advantages that people are going to have with technology in a post-COVID sort of economy, in a post-COVID sort of world, are going to be those that already have been programmed, if you will, for this remote working, and therefore become more dependent upon infrastructure that you're sort of talking about. Because, for example, that connectedness that you're talking about having between the development officer and the library, for most of us is going to come through some sort of a digital connection, right? And if that connection's not already there, the implementation of that process to make that happen is going to, that's a cultural change. And so all I'm getting at is it's going to be those institutions that already have those connections, for example, between the development officer and the library, that are going to have the possibly the upper hand going forward. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Look, I think in a way, everyone's not exactly on the level playing field, but, you know, whatever strategy you had, plan you had, objectives, everyone's strategy and plans, objectives should be kind of, I wouldn't say thrown out the window, but revisited, because every plan is predicated on a certain set of assumptions. We know those assumptions are wildly off now, and so that implies that we need to rethink things. Now, that, as I said, creates this opportunity, and I think it's going to accelerate change a little bit, because you have to be creative because so much has changed now, and that people that may have tried to do the same old, you know, whatever you were doing in the past, you can't just think that it's going to go back to that world and this is just a temporary thing and we can just keep doing the same software systems, the same processes, its metrics, et cetera. You know, this is an opportunity to really get creative and think. You know, it's not just about surviving, it's about surviving and thriving. And one of the great things about technology, how it can pull things together is, well, apart from, you know, creating institutional memory, right? It's about objective data, right? And when you have objective data, then everyone's talking the same language, right? And then you can, it's not guesswork anymore. You can, it can be data-driven decision-making. Again, the data, the information is coming from humans, and humans do the actual analysis and make the decisions from that. But you have a common framework to understand, again, how everything is connected. You know, what you do over here has this ripple effect, and the data can show that. You know, that's what we try and do, is connect these disparate pools of data so that people, we make it easier for people to see those connections, because that's the challenge. People are doing it by themselves. They're doing the best job they can, right? They're doing their very best, but they don't, you know, and sometimes you get so stuck in the weeds, you don't see the big picture. But everyone's more effective if you can understand, you know, how your piece, you know, how you, if you can optimize your piece, how then that in turn optimizes the effectiveness of the entire operation. So that's, I kind of see it's like the data is like the oil in the engine of the machine. It flows throughout the entire engine, and the engine is, you know, it's like the fundraise, you know, the university comprises of all these parts of the engine. And so the data becomes that oil that makes that engine run smoothly.
Yeah, you've given me some fascinating things to think about today, Arnie, and I get the privilege of going back and listening through all this, cleaning it up and taking all of our stutters out and stuff. But if some of our listeners are listening and they're like, I want to reach out to that guy, I want to hear more about QBAC, what's your suggestion on how they do that?
Right. I'm happy to connect with anyone on LinkedIn. So that's the great place to connect with me. And I've also got some things I've written up there you can check out. Also, please look at QBAC.org. That's QEBAC.org. Got lots of material on there. And just would love to connect with more people in the industry and continue the conversation.
All right, Arnie, it's been a pleasure. We'll certainly welcome you back.
Thanks okay. again. Thanks very much, Jason. Cheers, mate.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.